Hi, everybody. This is Mike Oppenheim, and you are listening to Coffin Talk, Interviews with the Living, a weekly podcast that explores how our views on death affect the way we live our life. This week, we have a very special guest, Eric Kaplan. He's a pretty famous writer and philosopher. He's written for Futurama, The Flight of the Conchords, The Big Bang Theory, and Young Sheldon. And his philosophy book, Does Santa Exist?, deals with ontology, logic, mysticism, and the philosophy of religion. His comedy philosophy podcast with Taylor Carman of Barnard College, Terrifying Questions, is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Music. And it's really exciting to have you on.
Well, I'm honored to be on.
Awesome. Our first question that we ask every guest, no matter what, is how old are you? Where did you grow up? And what generation, if any, do you consider yourself a member of?
I am 57 years old. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and I'm not sure what generation that puts me at. I'm pretty sure it's not the greatest, because it wasn't especially great. I hope it's not the worst. So I don't know, maybe somewhere in between the greatest and the worst generation.
Awesome. I have a feeling that certain generations would call the one right behind you the worst, but I don't think yours and mine is getting...
I will say this, mm-hmm. that my father was born in 1925. So that means I was raised by somebody older than most of my contemporaries. So I think I have a little bit of a, like, I'm not quite in sync with my generational cohort for that reason.
Wow, that resonates really deeply with me. And that's really interesting. I know a few people with kind of similar stories. When you were growing up, did you notice that your dad was like older, or did it not seem like anything to you? And then just later in life, you kind of figured that out.
I think it's like the water and the fish. It did not become obvious to me that I had different cultural touchstones than some of my contemporaries until I reflected on it later.
Okay, yeah.
But I'll give you an example. My grandfather was born in 1887.
Wow.
So that means someone who I have a living, vivid memory of is far closer to the American Revolution than to today.
That's really interesting. And I know that reminds me of the invention of the cell phone is closer to Cleopatra's lifetime than the Great Pyramid is to Cleopatra's lifetime. That always helps me.
Right. That's a good point. That is a good point.
Wow. That's really interesting. And so you have a great sense of humor. Do you think that your sense of humor might be like extra special in this time and age because you have that connection to a much more distant past than the average person your age?
Yes, almost certainly. You're correct.
Cool. I was a film and television major in undergrad, and but really what I love the most is comedy, and I got a lot of flack for that in film school because I would write serious papers on comedies, and I kind of am segueing this into, like, what are some of the early comedies that really informed you? Like, what are some of the things that maybe other people would hear and be able to look up and then discover for their own?
The Marx Brothers.
Nice.
Particularly Duck Soup and Horse Feathers. The W.C. Fields.
Nice.
Most especially The Fatal Glass of Beer. The early sort of 1930s and 1940s works of Mr. Bugs Bunny. The Hollywood comedies like The Awful Truth with Cary Grant and Irene Dunne. The Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Oh, I love that show.
And Monty Python's Flying Circus. So I would say those are the chief influences on me.
That's really cool. That's really interesting. I had a big poster of W.C. Fields in my bedroom when I was a kid, but I didn't know it was W.C. Fields. I just loved the picture and his face.
Who did you think it was?
I don't know. I thought it was a fat man from the past.
Right.
But I loved it. He was like, that picture was funny to me, you know?
One of my favorite quotes from W.C. Fields was, "Little girl, if I give you a dollar bill, will you sing for me?" It's a little creepy, isn't it?
It is very creepy. And actually, I'm curious, how often as a writer are you implanting homage or like actual direct like references to things from the past versus how often are people, do you think, picking up on it? I know there's no way to categorically answer this.
Oh, I disagree. I think there is a categorical way to answer it.
Oh, cool. Please. Yeah.
I'm never deliberately putting things in from the past.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I want to make it new.
Nice. That's cool. And actually, I have a very random question that just came to mind, but I am not a fan of the reboot remake cycles. None of it. I just don't like any of it. I would prefer...
You don't like anything that's been remade?
I'm trying to think of, there might be like a Hitchcock that was remade that I was okay with, not by someone else, like he remade his own film. I'm trying to think, there's definitely something I'm okay with.
I think it's more interesting and challenging and fun to do something new. And I think it's a sign of a more creative, vital, and I'll even say vivacious culture to come up with new ideas and new characters rather than reboot or retread something that's already been made.
And so moving into the other part of your career, which is something we also share, my other major in college was philosophy, and this podcast is a somewhat philosophical podcast. With a tie into what you just said, where do you feel like we're at philosophically as a culture, specifically Western culture, and just like all things comedy and entertainment?
Well, I'm not 100% sure how to answer your question. I think there's a couple of important things that are happening globally. One of them is global mass communications, so that people have more of a sense of, you know, that you can simultaneously talk to people from all parts of the globe at the same time. And I think there's a certain simultaneity of the past that is interesting, that I would say any philosophical or religious view that has been recorded, you can find someone on the internet who espouses that view. I think, obviously, the global climate crisis and the sense of the fragility and the interconnectedness of the global ecosystem is something that is important philosophically. And I think we're also, I would hope, looking at a transition away from modes of human interaction based on patriarchy and domination.
That's awesome. I'm not quite so optimistic about the last three, but I'm hopeful for all three. So that's interesting.
Yeah. Well, I feel that pessimism is a luxury we can ill afford.
Yeah. I write a lot, and that's pretty much my message. I'm not pessimistic so much as I've lost the glowing optimism for the near term. I'm more like I think 2035 is going to be awesome.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a tough run to get there. That's where I'm kind of at.
Okay.
And that's based on just cycles of history. Like, I don't think history repeats itself, but it rhymes, you know?
Perseverance keeps honor bright, huh?
Yes, definitely. And I think that there's still more digging to do. I think that people, you know, there's that the name of the show, Black Mirror, to me is kind of like a good apt name for like this time, which is, I think we're looking at mirrors, but we're not looking at them from the right perspective.
What perspective would you like us to look at them from?
I'd like us to look at the perspective of real conversations that are going on and not the conversations that are being highlighted from the internet, because I'm skeptical as to whether they're real. And also I feel like people will say things to get indirect attention on the internet that they wouldn't say and don't actually feel in person.
I think you're right. I think that's an excellent point. I think one of the things is, like, if you wanted to write a letter to the editor and express your dopey opinion about some conspiracy you believe in, at least you needed to have the skills to afford a stamp. But not true with the internet.
Yeah.
The barrier of expression and dissemination of an opinion is zero.
Mm-hmm.
So since it's free, many more foolish and ill-considered opinions, or even opinions that people don't really believe, that they're just saying to get people to pay attention to them, are disseminated.
Yeah. And also, this segues into another question I would love to ask you. Is leadership a problem, or is the problem that people rely on leadership? I mean, I'm sure it's a combination of both, but do you understand what I'm trying to ask about where we're headed and leadership?
I don't entirely understand what you mean. You know, I'm in favor of democratic institutions. So I think, in a sense, the collective is the leader, and we can seek out certain people who are good at making quick decisions in a crisis or are particularly well-informed to aid us in our decision-making. But I believe we are leading ourselves.
And so with regards to climate and the patriarchy and civil rights and all these things, I think the question I'm trying to ask is, sometimes I'm not worried, I'm not going to use that word, but sometimes I wonder if people are waiting for leaders when really they should just be leading themselves, like in everyday interactions and, you know, just everywhere you go.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I do think there's something in our social practices now which makes us feel isolated and passive. And that's unfortunate. Like, that's bad. And I think when people take an in-person, active, participatory role in their communities and their workplaces, it's much better. That's why unions are important.
Oh, that's a good point.
Everybody should join a union if they can.
So what has surprised you the most in the last 20, 25 years philosophically? Like, which philosophical threads that are now part of the mainstream have surprised you the most?
Oh, I don't know that anything has surprised me. I don't know that there is a philosophical mainstream. There wasn't 25 years ago, and I don't think there is now. I don't think it's a terribly popular activity.
I think what I meant was more like democracy is a type of philosophy. It's where you believe that.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I was surprised by the rise of I don't know, I guess I would call it a fascist movement in the United States. I didn't see that coming.
Yeah, I did not either. My brother lives in New York. We were both born there, but I've not really lived there. But I am from the Bay Area of California. And now I live in Phoenix, Arizona. And so I kind of have noticed that, like, philosophy is also, you know, local and nationwide. And so with all of these threads and all the things we've been discussing and stuff, do you think the internet, individual voices, mass attention, things going viral, do you think we're more or less likely to come to, like, a cohesive, somewhat agreeable opinion, specifically in this nation?
Oh, so is the question, do I think the internet is making it harder for people to agree with each other?
Well, less so that than America in particular. Do you think we're actually headed towards more cohesion eventually? Because we talked about the rise of fascism.
Yeah, well, I think there's a few structural issues that need to be addressed. One is the Senate, which is very anti-democratic, and the Supreme Court is very anti-democratic.
Yeah.
And then another one is Citizens United, the massive infusion of money into political advertising, and also the huge wealth gap, the concentration of wealth, because I think that makes it very difficult, because you have a small group of people who are very, very rich, and they can hire an army of lawyers and public relations executives and lobbyists to sort of spew out lies into the public discourse and mislead people and confuse people. So I think those three things are sort of putting some sand in the gears right now.
Well said. And so now we're going to shift into kind of the other third of this podcast, which is the title, Coffin Talk. And so what I like to do is interview guests about their personal life and their career, and then also about, in general, their philosophy and how they live their life. But then I like to tie it in to metaphysics, which is, does any of this have actual meaning to you in a much, much, much larger context? And so before I can get into all those kind of questions, I am curious, what do you think happens to you when you die? What do you think will happen to you when you die?
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to Coffin Talk. I am proud to say that we are offering premium subscriptions at my website, mikeyopp.com. That's MIKEYOPP.com. So please head over and consider supporting us. Thank you so much.
Well, I think I'm sort of a mixture of the eternal and the temporal. And when I die, in some way, that mixture will become unmixed. And whatever aspect of me that is eternal will continue in its eternity. And whatever aspect of me is that is temporal will pass from the scene.
That's a Great answer. I've done 170 something of these interviews. I've never heard anything articulated that way and as concisely as you did. I really like that answer. Now I'd love to unpack it a little bit. So to what extent do you, the mixture of these two components, think that any of this matters? Like, does it matter if fascism takes an even further hold of America and if people die in that process in a metaphysical, eternal context?
I think it matters a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Very much.
And how so?
Why would it not matter?
Well, it depends on the perspective of judging what matters. Like, is there a official board? You know, this. I'm not saying this is what I think. I'm asking.
I think it matters. It feels like it matters.
Mm, I like that.
It looks like it matters. I don't. I know there are some people who think that they have arguments for why it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm suspicious of all such arguments because I think they're an effort to insulate ourselves from pain and disappointment.
Wow, I like that. Yeah. So how do you not insulate yourself from the suffering of others while simultaneously not letting that suffering be so overbearing that you cannot function, laugh, go on with your life?
Well, I need to have some awareness of the fact that even though I have some responsibilities, I'm also a very tiny, finite being, almost like those things you see skittering around on the surface of ponds, you know. Mm-hmm. In the ultimate scheme of things, I'm an extremely tiny, weak, and vulnerable being. So I can't really expect myself to solve everything. I don't have the wisdom or the resources or the power to do that. I'll do the best I can.
Mm-hmm.
In a part of the Talmud called Perkei Avot, the teachings of the fathers, it says, you're not expected to complete the task, but that doesn't give you permission to quit.
I really like that answer because I've looked for permission. So were you raised Jewish and are you currently practicing?
I was raised Jewish and I am Jewish.
Cool.
But I'm a non ethnocentric kind of Jew. I don't feel that we have a particular monopoly on wisdom or virtue.
Yeah. Thank you for stating it that way. I like that. I'm going to try to remember to say that to people when they ask me if I'm Jewish, because I struggle immensely to answer that question.
Mm-hmm.
Would you consider yourself an optimist?
Yeah, I'm an optimist. Sure.
And how many of your friends, how many people that you really interact with throughout the course of your life are into comedy and philosophy and are optimists? I'm just curious.
Oh, I think it's just me.
Okay. Because those are my main interests.
Comedy, philosophy, and optimism?
Yeah. It's just, I mean, my friends would make fun of me for philosophy and optimism more than, you know, comedy, but...
Well, they're just defending themselves. They're just being defensive. Don't worry about what your friends have to say. If your friends told you to jump off the Brooklyn Bridge, would you?
No, but this reminds me of your father, because that's something that my father's father would have told me.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, speaking of your career and comedy, not what is like the greatest thing you've ever done, but what was the most fun project you've ever worked on?
Huh. Well, Zombie College was pretty fun. That was a lot of fun. The Drinky Crow show was pretty fun. Futurama was pretty fun. Flight of the Conchords was pretty fun. I mean, they've all been fun in some way, you know.
Very cool.
You can always find some fun in a situation.
Have you ever been asked to, like, go against your sense of integrity in a way that wasn't, like, you know, go kill that person, but it was like, hey, we want this line to be, you know, punched up this way? Have you ever been asked to do that and consented? Or, like, what is that like, that struggle, if it's ever happened to you?
It's a struggle because when I'm working for somebody else, I've been hired to help them achieve their vision.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes their vision is aesthetically not my vision. And sometimes it portrays human life in ways that I don't agree with.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, it's the job that I'm helping them achieve something rather than grabbing the reins and trying to achieve it myself. And even in the case where I'm a showrunner, you know, there are other stakeholders, mm-hmm. and there's the audience. So when you're talking to the audience, you sometimes, when, you know, this is very clear, when you have a live audience, they'll reject something. And it's, you're creating an energetic exchange and a communication with the audience. Mm-hmm. So it's not possible to just do it your way, which I think maybe feel like it has less quote unquote integrity than staying in your attic, writing a perfect novel and then descending and giving it to everybody. And that might be true, or you might think that it's a different kind of integrity, or it's a different kind of activity. I don't know. It's, to be honest, it's something that I wrestle with, and I haven't reached a conclusion.
Awesome. I still really appreciate that answer, though. And forgive me again, because some of my research for you was the laziest form possible, which is reading a Wikipedia page, but that is mm-hmm. the extent of my time and certain things with that regards. But
no, you got a lot to do, man. Don't beat yourself up.
Thanks. I used to teach ESL, and I used to live in Thailand, and I saw that you were there, and then you became a professional writer after that, and that's...
I did. I was a Buddhist monk at Wat Chu Lamani.
Wow.
And I taught at Awithyalai Kru Pibun Songkram.
Wow.
Which I understand is not Awithyalai Kru anymore. I think it's become a college or a university.
Oh, okay. But
when I was there, it was a teacher's college, Awithyalai Kru.
That's awesome. And what I was curious, did you have an experience that led you to say, hey, I'm actually going to become a professional writer? Was like there a aha moment in your life, or was it just a gradual process?
Well, so I wrote when I was a kid. So I've always been writing. My decision to become a professional writer had something to do with being worried that I would not be able to get a job as a college professor.
Ah, wow.
And I thought, I don't know if I'm going to be able to get a job as a college professor, so maybe I should leave grad school and try and get a job. So that's really what happened. On some level, I think I was also eager to be able to connect to more people. And I thought that a life of academia would make that more difficult. That's basically, I was a grad school dropout. The turning point was when I dropped out of grad school. I was going to grad school at UC Berkeley. I completed my oral exam, and I had to write my dissertation, and instead, I dropped out.
Wow, that's fascinating. I love that story.
But just the audience should realize, I ultimately wrote my dissertation, so I do have a PhD. They're not listening to a podcast by someone who ultimately didn't complete his dissertation. I did.
That's very cool. Did you have to have your same advisor approve it, or was there a new advisor by then?
Yes, I had my same advisor approve it, Bert Greif.
Wow, that's awesome. I'm actually not negative or pessimistic or all in on artificial intelligence. I'm just kind of a, hey, I'll see where this leads us. Do you have a strong opinion about it? Has your opinion changed over the years?
I think artificial intelligence is much, much less interesting and much less likely to do anything important than a lot of people. I'm a sort of an AI skeptic.
Awesome.
Because I think what we've learned to do in our society is create a lot of sort of empty, vacuous, bureaucratic speech. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it was a job of humans to, you know, create a, like you call up and you say, you know, I rented this apartment and it's spewing boiling water out of the toilet, and then you'll get a letter and say, I'm so sorry, it didn't reach your needs. We hope to be of more help in the future. So you'll get a mindless corporate response in many situations in our society. And now we have automated that. But I don't find it terribly interesting, because I think the fact that we are having people write mindless corporate things or mindless bureaucratic things was already pretty stupid. Like, it's a bad sign that we spend a lot of time writing things that are meaningless. So the fact that we have computers, you know, trained on all the meaningless garbage that has been written and creating more meaningless garbage, I don't find interesting. I also don't find it pleasing. but more interestingly, I don't find it interesting.
Eric, that was the best answer. I wish I could have predicted that was going to be the answer, because I would have been in a giddy, great mood all day. So at the end of the interview, we always just give our guests the chance to have the floor, and we let them say whatever they want to our audience. So what would you like to tell our audience?
I would like to tell your audience that I love you and I believe in you, and you can go out and connect with people and make your life full of zest and joy.
Awesome. I love that. And I definitely take encouragement from that, as that is what I am trying to do in my life still at the age of 42. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And thank you so much for your time.
And my pleasure. And I've got a blog on WordPress. Mm-hmm. EricLinusKaplan.wordpress.com. And people want to read that.
Definitely. And we'll put notes in the bio. And to those of you at home, please remember to check out the notes for more stuff on how to find him, including his podcast and his blog. And if you want to support the show, the best way to do that is head over to mikeyop.com. That's mikeyop.com. And please subscribe to the program. You can also help support the show with a premium subscription. Thanks so much, and we'll see you soon.